I also have a colleague, a coworker with me that is deaf as well, sitting to my right. Her name is Denise Thu Hackett, and we are here representing FEMA. And the reason I'm here, my specific role is Disability Integration Specialist for Region 10 in FEMA. I'm responsible to support Alaska, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. Those are the four states in our region, and I support them all. My role with disability integration is to advocate for people with disabilities and help kind of collaborate and network, you know, connect people together, start conversations before, during, and after disasters. So my background is I was born deaf using ASL and born to a hearing family. I was the only deaf person in my family. Grew up in a farm town in Staten, Oregon, and there I was labeled, you know, with special needs, special education, very, very different views of me. And because of that, my options for work were very limited. I grew up in a lot of, you know, on the farm, a lot of mechanics and working on that blue collar work until 2008 when the economy went down. And then it became really tough. Couldn't get promoted. People viewed me as I wasn't safe because I couldn't hear, couldn't use the radio, all of those things. So I had an opportunity to go back to school and get my bachelor's degree, a second bachelor's degree in sociology and philosophy. And then I went into grad school for rehab counseling for the deaf. And after that, I moved to Arizona and I lived there for 12 years. And I worked as a VR counselor and got promoted to a lead counselor and a supervisor, regional supervisor. So that's kind of my background experience I've had has been in vocational rehab and Center for Independent Living and employment, like job coaching, and helping people with informed choice and independent choices. And then I had the background of working with people that are deaf, hard of hearing, deaf blind, visually impaired, and a lot of disabilities as well. So that's kind of the overall experience I've had. So now you may be wondering why I decided to, you know, work for FEMA and, you know, I got hired into this role with no prior emergency management experience. So this is a brand new world for me. I've really learned a lot and appreciated everything I've learned a lot, but I have also got to bring that vocational rehab background into this role and identify different challenges, bumps in the road, concerns that are happening. So, you know, my whole world has kind of shifted. And, you know, the world shifts, the weather shifts. That's one of the things that has changed. And I'm sure you all are aware as people with disabilities, we depend a lot on, you know, access to information and having access, like in our everyday life, how we make choices for ourselves. If we don't have that access to the information, we can't make those decisions. So I am here to kind of help build and bridge that gap. The main reason I'm here in Alaska actually is because we had a disaster in Juneau. So they had recent flooding and they had, you know, prior flooding from that a couple months ago. So that's the specific disaster we're here for to do. You know, they did the damage assessments and everything. So now people are applying for assistance, for individual assistance to help people that were affected, survivors from the disaster. So whatever things were damaged or things that need replaced, all of those things we help with. So I'm actually going to Juneau tomorrow morning, and I'm going to be there on site for at least a week, possibly longer. It just depends what the community needs. So I would love to kind of reach out and ask you all if you know anyone in Juneau that was affected, please, you know, let me know if there's any community partners, anything like related to people with disabilities, please, you know, let me know. I'm happy to sit down and meet with them while I'm there. If you know any specific survivors that have disabilities, you know, blind, visually impaired, anything like that, that were affected by the flood, please let me know. Reach out to me. I'm really, you know, I'm happy to help them. I don't work directly with the survivors, but I help connect them with the right people and the right information and the right resources. FEMA can be very, very overwhelming. I know that for sure. So I've only been here maybe about 2 months. So I'm still overwhelmed by everything I've been learning. So I can't imagine how a disaster would, or how a survivor would feel that's affected by a disaster, learning how to go through FEMA and everything else that they're going through. So that's the main goal. And because I am new, if you do have any questions or concerns, I'm happy to take those, but also understand I may be limited to provide any answers because I'm still learning things myself. So please bear with me. If you do have questions I can't answer, I will try to find them out. So I think that's everything from me. Does anyone have any questions? I see a few. There's a guy in the back. You have a mic. Yes.
This is Rolando. How accessible are the forms? How accessible are the forms?
Accessible are the forms,
right? Yes, the forms. That's a great question. Unfortunately, it depends. And I'm sure you love that phrase. It depends. it depends on which form, depends on where you got the form, and it depends on what the form is for. So it depends on what kind of access you need as well for the form. For example, if it's Braille, to actually get the form and see that it doesn't have Braille, maybe they gave you the wrong form. There are some forms that are friendly, like where you can zoom in. And, you know, if you have a reader, you can use those. There are some forms that don't have a good font for, you know, zooming in and having the font be bigger. So for example, I'm kind of curious, what font do you all prefer? Yeah. That's what I told FEMA. I was like, oh, this should be either Arial or Verdana. Sorry, this interpreter cannot pronounce that word. So one of those two are the two preferred ones. They tend to use Frank and Gaelic Gothic. Thank you. And I told them, I was like, no, that's not the best. So that's all set up from headquarters. And I, you know, I'm having these discussions saying, you know, this is not the most accessible font that we could be using. That means that, you know, is that will that translate over in Braille? No. Is it reader friendly? You know, maybe not. So that's one of the things that I need your help with is, you know, people that are going through disasters and impacted by that, trying to fill out a form that's not accessible, let me know. And then I can bring that up and say, hey, we have a survivor that had this issue. Is there any other questions? Kevin? Yeah. Okay.
I know we just recently had a landslide in Ketchikan, and I am aware of at least one blind individual that lives in Ketchikan. And I just wonder, was FEMA there, and was there anyone reaching out to them from the blind community?
That is another great question. I do know about that disaster, and I know as of right now, we have staff there, I believe, arrived last week. They were doing PDAs. They're called preliminary damage assessments, PDA for short. That's the process that FEMA has to go through when the state requests for assistance from FEMA. So when that process begins, then there's a bunch of, you know, things they have to go through, criteria that has to be met for a disaster declaration. And if those are all met, and the disaster gets declared, then FEMA can get involved with the assistance and help with applications and things like that. Until that disaster becomes federally declared, we just kind of have to wait to see if the criteria from the preliminary damage assessment meets the criteria. So we actually can't be involved in advocating or anything like that until it gets declared. But if you do have anyone there that could be affected, feel free to give them my information and I can, you know, let them know what the process is once it gets declared. And then if you all want, what I can do is when I get, when I am informed that the disaster declaration is approved, I can share that with Kevin and he can share that with the community. And then also sometimes the state. Who and what starts the disaster process? It starts at the state or the tribe. They have to actually initiate the request to get federal assistance. In some situations, they do work together. Sometimes they prefer to be separate. And sometimes the state prefers to go with the federal assistance and the tribe decides not to. So there are some challenges at the local level that kind of trickle up. So it depends if the state wants to do it their own way for an assessment, kind of figure out what they need, and then pass it on for a federal review. The general process is that the governor for the state or the leader for the tribe has to initiate the request for a disaster declaration and then do the damage assessment, see if it fits the criteria, and then possibly send that off to FEMA for request. And if all of that is the criteria is met and they make the recommendation, the state and the leaders sign it, approve it, then, you know, they have to agree, figure out, kind of work out all the details, how to split the responsibilities and the cost sharing, all of those details. And then it gets sent to the president for final review to get approved. The president approves, signs it. Then it gets declared. Then FEMA is officially involved in the process. Yes, that's a very, very, I missed a lot of steps in there. You know, I'm still learning the process, but it is a very lengthy process. If we have a big storm like hurricane and we know it's coming, they can predict that it's going to be a really bad disaster. Then they can start with some of the preliminary disaster declaration. That process can start. For other situations that are unpredictable, for example, like a landslide or, major earthquake, just like that, exactly. You can't really predict those events. So we have to wait for that to, you know, finish, get the damage assessment, you know, have the level of responders, make sure everyone's safe, recovered, you know, if there's search and rescue involved. And then that process starts of a cost estimate, see how much it's going to cost to repair things. And, you know, there is another thing that you guys can do right now. We have what's called a hazard mitigation grant program. And that program is specifically designed intentionally to help communities who tend to be impacted by disasters. And that grant money can help with some of the cost sharing, not all of it, but to help improve the infrastructure, community response, anything like with an alert system for the community. And that kind of helps reduce the impact from a severe disaster. So a good example of that is just recently we finished a project with a tribe in Washington, and they were building a specific, what they call, tsunami evacuation tower. So what they did with that is, you know, there's a lot of people that can't evacuate if, you know, there's no warning, not letting them know before. So using the grant, it got approved. So the tribe can help pay, FEMA can help pay to build that evacuation tower. So now if the community is impacted by a tsunami, they have a place to evacuate to that would be safe for them to preserve their community. So we have those kinds of potential discussions in the grant program. Of course, you know, if you have any specific areas of concern or if you have any gaps that you guys can identify and needs to help with disaster mitigation, that could be a good program to consider. And, you know, I'm happy if anyone is interested in having those discussions for the grant program. Any more questions?
This is Kevin. Again, from the moment the governor signs a declaration of emergency to the time FEMA gets in the state and gets involved, it's just a matter of getting the stuff signed and pushed through to until FEMA's on hand?
It's a good question. It's very complicated.
Of course. Of course.
Yeah. So local communities, counties, tribes, state, they can declare a disaster themselves. It does not mean that FEMA is going to be involved. Anytime FEMA is involved for a disaster declaration, it has to have the president's approval. So for example, once the president approves it, then there is that process. Have to fill out a damage estimate and all of these things, that there's a specific process. So it can take anywhere from 3 months to a year or 2 years. For example, the Juneau flooding that happened, I believe it happened in August 5th and 6th was when it recently happened. And then, you know, that was just 2 months ago. And then they did the damage assessment. The state declared a disaster, processed, did all the criteria, got all the information they needed, provided that over to the headquarters for FEMA for review. They agreed that it matched the criteria for the damage. And then the president approved it and signed it. And FEMA got involved. I think it was just about 2 weeks ago is when FEMA started to formally get involved in the process. So that was about a 2-month process for Juneau. And then to add to that, there are some states at the state level, they take care of things. So because of disasters, they do share the cost share responsibility. So one thing you want to look at is the formula of how the state or the local governments and tribes, what money they have, what resources they have available to manage the disaster themselves. If they have it, then they don't necessarily need FEMA to get involved if they can handle it on their own level. If after that they feel like they don't have enough money, not enough resources available for the disaster, then that's where they can request formally FEMA to become involved in the process. Sometimes we have state level disasters, excuse me, that are declared and they can handle them at a local level with resources and funding. And sometimes they don't need or they don't want FEMA involved. So they will handle that at their own level. All right. Any more questions?
Katie was wondering if FEMA was involved in the landslide in Seward when the road collapsed or the landslide blocked off that last Lowell Point area for over a month during that cleanup.
2 years ago. If it was small enough that the state can handle it, then they probably don't have to have FEMA involved. They can take on that responsibility themselves. If they want FEMA to become involved, then, you know, the president can unfortunately sometimes deny. So if the state goes through the appeal process, that appeal process I'm not familiar with, so I can't speak on that. But, you know, if you want, you can email me and ask me that question, and then I can find that information out and then let you know what that disaster looked like, if there was any, you know, issues with that. And then from there on, you can communicate with the contact I have.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I see another question to my right.
Hi, it's Linda, and I'm hoping to catch you on the flight tomorrow back to Juneau. Just a quick question, and it could be now or tomorrow. Just wondering who you've reached out to already in Juneau to help me know who to try to connect you with that you haven't already connected with.
For Juneau specifically, I don't have anyone yet.
Okay. All right.
That's part of why I'm here now.
Excellent. Okay. I'll connect you with the Independent Living Center, and I'll see if I can get you with the mayor, who's been working very hard. I'll try to find those connections.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds great. Looking forward to working with you. So I think I'll turn that back over to Kevin.
Thank you so very much, PV. That was a great unexpected presentation. We're glad you're here. I want to make sure you and I stay in contact so I can get your information out and you and I can stay in contact. And, you know, let's build and develop this relationship so that others know you were there. We're there for you. And we can move forward with progress and make things happen. We have two controllers for the accessible voting. I know Brian Blair has used those controllers. They have Braille on them. What I'd like to do is pass those controllers around the room. And Brian, if you could give us a little audio description of the function of them and what you went through as you voted.
So just curious, how many of y'all have voted using the accessible voting machines, you know, online? We got a few. Okay.
This is Nate. I've used them. I've used it previously a couple of times.
Great. I not really heard this from anybody officially in the division, elections division, but this past time when I voted in the August primary, I was pleasantly surprised. Quite frankly, never really liked these machines and the system. I just thought it was very clunky. And I don't think that it, you know, I think they did some major firmware upgrade. And I don't know if anybody else had reactions or, you know, thoughts about that. But I was really impressed with the way it worked this time. Part of it was that I'm in Glen Allen. Our poll workers knew how to do it. And this time they had kind of got caught off guard with it a few times. But this last time they were ready. And when I walked in, it worked and everything worked well. And the speech seemed to be greatly improved. Just the whole way it worked just seemed a lot smoother and flowed a lot better, I thought, than when I had done it 2 years ago. And certainly when they first came out with these things, I think back in 2018 or 2016. I find them a little disconcerting because it's not a keyboard that I've ever been familiar with or seen. And I don't know, Nate, do you know, is this like any kind of standard keyboard for anything else besides this?
Not that I know of. And I think the system, remember right at one point, because we had one here at the center for 2 or 3 weeks, maybe on an Android system, but I don't believe I used the keyboard for anything.
Okay. Well, I think it's greatly improved, and just, I'll just go through this really fast, but you can, because what I found out, this has Braille labels, and I'm a pretty proficient Braille reader, I think, but just the layout and where the Braille labels were the first few times I touched this was a little confusing. But so they have labels, and we'll pass these around. You can see them because it might be a little helpful, but I found out that the guidance this time was a whole lot better as far as how to do it. And like the very first thing it told you is if you wanted that your screen, you could darken, you could put a curtain on your screen, you know, like not turn the screen curtain on. It didn't used to tell you that. And, you know, hey, that's part of the whole reason. And the Help America Vote Act and all this stuff was passed. And is that we say as blind people, we should be able to do a secret ballot just like anybody else. And if you're sitting out there in the middle of a polling place and everybody can see what you're doing, that's not happening. And if you have to have somebody vote for you or do it for you, then it's not either. And so that's why I think this is really important. And I think they've made some big improvements, probably a little bit of push from the feds with the letter that they sent to the Division of Elections earlier this summer, maybe help things out a little bit. That's great. That's correct. So, yeah, just on the top there, you got left and right buttons for volume on the left top. On the right top, there are left and right volumes for the rate, which will speed up the rate of how fast they're talking. Right below on the left side are left and right arrows, and that's going to take you through the different parts of your ballot. And the big thing in the middle is a star, and that usually is going to be your select button. And at the bottom is a big long thing, which I am assuming that's help. And so that's the way that works. So when you are in the polling place, there will be a pair of headphones, and they'll have protectors on them. They'll put on new thingies every time somebody else comes in. That'll be plugged into the front of this little device. It'll be connected. It's got a, looks like an RJ45, or no, maybe that's not. Anyway, it's going to be connected in to the system, and you will access it, and it'll talk to you if that's the way you choose to do it. There's also a touch screen if you want to do it that way, if you have some vision. So I found I was pleasantly surprised in this August primary. It's gotten a little more confusing here because of ranked choice voting. You know, it's a little more complex than it used to be. But even so, with this, with the upgrades they made, I think this was by far the best experience I've ever had with it. So I am thankful for that. And I think just you can pass these things around and look at them. They're not active. They're not connected to anything. You won't hear anything, but you can at least get a feel for what it is and you see it. So that's all I have to say about it. Oh, okay.
This is Linda, and I just wanted to share as well. I voted in the primary using the machine, and the tutorial at the beginning really helped, and I was able to hear and listen and find my way through it. And then I just early voted a couple days ago on the machine, and this time I used the voice and the large screen, and I think it's a little easier than having the matrix box that's out there for the ranked choice voting. We just got to go through, I got to go through and do 1 through 8, and it was kind of like VoiceOver where I tapped on the large print, it read what it was, I second tapped, selected it. If you weren't happy with that choice, you could tap again and unselect it. At the end, it gave you the chance to review before you sign off that you're done. So it wasn't as intimidating as I feared. So, yes.
So when you did that, when you touched them, would they talk?
Yes.
Okay, because I'm wondering if a blind person could use just the touch screen.
That's what I ended up using, and I had the headphones on, and I didn't use this little gadget.
I have some vision, so I didn't know.
The first tap read it. The second tap selected it. A third tap unselected it.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
This is Nate. Can you all still hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, so I just want to make a point for everyone. You know, we are discussing this controller and the voting. That's one part of it. But the hope is also that everyone can understand and acknowledge that to get to this point where we can access these voting machines and exercise our rights, that's NFB. That's the Center for the Blind. That's people advocating. So, you know, I want to kind of point that out so we can acknowledge it and have that gratitude, because without people collecting together, without people sharing, without people sacrificing their time, your time, we don't get things like this. And so if we don't acknowledge it, then that privilege, you know, we take it for granted as a luxury when it's really not.
There is a hotline number I will be sending out. It's got sent out to me. So we want to hear about your voting experiences. If you're having any issues, let us know. We want to possibly file a claim. We want to hear about your good experiences, you know, and it's been through the advocacy of the blind Alaskans that actually had DOJ and the Division of Elections doing all they're doing right now to make it accessible for us. So let's be, you know, diligent and make the best of this voting experience. You know, early voting is open. So I went and picked up these controllers yesterday. There were lines out the door. So, you know, we're having a tremendous year of people voting. So we want to hear about your experience and whether it be good or bad. And if claim needs to be filed, let's file it. The Division of Elections did come by the Alaska Center for the Blind. They set up the mock setup for us to be able to have access to the machine. We tried it out, and also they were letting us know the machine is in different languages. Also, I was able to reach out to the individual. They were telling me if I was going to vote in person, where I was, but where to go vote in person the day of. So, and at the polling sites there, they will have these machines available for us too.
Katie.
Go ahead, Katie.
If you don't know where you need to go for voting on that day, if you show up in one of the polling places, they should be able to pull up what district ballot you have by your location. They cannot turn you away and say, no, you have to go somewhere else. They are able to make that adjustment and add it. That was my experience the last time when DOJ with Elizabeth and them came up and they were touring and evaluating each station. We went to a new place that was not my location because they needed to go explore that and evaluate and see how things went. And the first thing that they did when we walked in was after greeting us, they automatically asked Elizabeth and the other person if I needed to use the machine instead of speaking to me directly. And they corrected them. Elizabeth and the others corrected them, saying that talk to her, speak to her, you know, and they were able to pull up. The only challenge was is that when they had to fill out the envelope for the ballot, is that they had to handwrite it in, and pretty much everybody can hear what my address was. I was able to vote at that location.
Good, good. Now, early voting places is going to be the Division of Elections, 2525 Fireweed Lane, City Hall, also the library, and then day of voting will be at your polling place. And like Katie was saying, you could go to any of the polling places if you're not sure, find out where you're supposed to vote and or submit an absentee ballot at that place.
This is Nate again. Earlier in the day, the better. And even if you don't have your ballot, say something, maybe it got lost or it didn't go where you thought it was going, you can still go and vote and you'll fill out, you know, your kind of affidavit saying I and he am I. And so forth and so on. So whatever it takes, just get over there. And day of, sometimes transportation, there's different options. There's discounts to be able to ride different places. And so keep an ear out for that as well.
If you schedule with Anchor Rides the whole day, no matter where you go, Anchor Rides is free on election day as well.
Bonnie Lucas, I just want to make everyone aware that I don't know when early voting ends in Alaska, but it is probably very soon.
Sunday. And who is this?
Okay, that's right. That's Bonnie.
Who?
Bonnie.
Oh, okay. Just checking. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, hi, Kevin.
This is Charlie, and I just wanted to add a comment. The last two times I voted for the primary and this election, and I was just quite pleased with how the folks, election people at City Hall and just working with the machine, that worked out really nicely. So I'll definitely have to say that to the, that voter hotline that you said.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Charlie. And yes, I will be getting that number out to everybody. And I will say, Alaska got a F on their report card for the Division of Elections and Voting. And the local news agencies has reached out to the Center for the Blind and to the blind community on their experiences in their voting places and what's taking place. So, you know, Division of Elections is working on making things better for us, but it's up to us to make ourselves heard, to make our points clear, and for us to exercise our rights to vote as blind individuals.
I am a guide dog handler myself from Guiding Eyes from the Blind. Kevin is also a guide dog handler in the room, and Guide Dog Foundation. Katie and Nate are both online, yeah, with Guiding Eyes as well. Kevin, do you want to share some words about your school and your dog handling experience?
When I signed up for a guide dog, it was like the whoever picked me first, that's where I went. And I signed up with Fidelco, Leader Dog, Guiding Eyes, Guide Dog Foundation, Guide Dogs for the Blind. I signed up for everyone. And it just so happened that Guide Dog Foundation picked me. And it turned out they have a 2-week program, which I absolutely loved. And, you know, in 2 weeks, I got trained. The dog was already trained. They had to train me to be with the dog. So it was, you know, the matching process was phenomenal. With just a couple of 2 or 3 phone calls, they matched the personality up with mine, and the dog was great. You know, and it's so good that I'm going back to the Guide Dog Foundation for another dog. Of course, that's my way of showing loyalty. And, you know, I have nothing bad to say about them. And every guide dog school has their own breeding program. They breed their own dogs, and they, you know, the dog comes first. While I was at my school, there was an individual there who had some pain issues, and he was on some heavy medication. And when it came right down to it, the guide dog school didn't think him getting a dog at that time was a good match. Their concern is the guide dog, and he didn't get a dog. And, you know, I was sad to see that, but at the same time, you know, they're looking out for the safety of the dog. So they earned my respect with that right there in itself. And I know the other guide dog schools feel the same way. You know, it's the dog safety first. And of course, our safety comes right along in there with it. But I'm very proud of the Guide Dog Foundation. And if anybody has any question on that, please reach out to me. I'd love to give you some more information on that. Thank you, guys.
Kevin, how long have you been a guide dog handler?
Raja and I have been together going on 10 years. We said he's super dog. He's almost 12 years old. I'm already in the process of getting a new dog. As soon as they call me, I'm ready to go down and get one. Raja has slowed down a little bit, but he's still pretty spry. He still loves leading me. If I had him right now, he'd run me right outside, get me where I need to go. He's still doing his job, and after a while, the dog takes on the owner's personality. Now you know why Raja's so cool.
Thank you, Kevin. Katie, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Do you want to talk a little bit about Guiding Eyes?
Sure. Guiding Eyes is based in Yorktown Heights, New York. When I lost my vision, there was a lot of stuff happening. I was encouraged to research multiple different schools because each school has different things to offer. Like Guide Dog Foundation, they have their own items that they prefer and recommend. Guide Dogs for the Blind, there's a lot of medical abilities to assist in that. Guiding Eyes, they provide a voucher and help you get started, but support you in your independence and maintaining and taking care of the dog and the responsibilities. They also have a running program, which I did not participate in, but we have others that have. I chose Guiding Eyes because it was more of, there was so much information. I was so overwhelmed, and I decided to apply for one, see what happened, and go from there. Usually the waiting list is quite a ways in a time frame. I applied in the fall of 2019, and in December, a few weeks in, I got the notification I was approved. A few days later, I got a phone call saying that they think they may have a match for me and asked me to come in February of 2020. My graduation with Dozer in 2020 was the last one live graduation before the COVID pandemic hit. And I am truly blessed because Dozer kept my sanity. I was isolated down in Seward. It was just me and school and Dozer. And I don't know where I'd be if it wasn't for him as a benefit and receiving him when I did. But we got to still work on our team and our training out in the middle of nowhere during the pandemic, which I think helped a lot because a lot of teams did not make it due to the pandemic. It threw in a wrench in a lot of things and a lot of the schools and the puppies and what happened. So I'm truly blessed that we were able to team up as we did.
Thank you, Katie.
Thanks.
Nate, can you speak a little about Guiding Eyes running program?
So Guiding Eyes, to my knowledge, was the first and still is the only guide dog school that has a running program. And this consists of them choosing some of their dogs that they see fit to train not only to be a guide dog, but also to be a running guide. And so when you request this to be in this program, it may take additional time. So rather than taking 8 months to a year, 6 months to a year, it could take 18 months to 2 years in order for them to make sure that they have a dog ready for you that can also go out and guide you while you are running. And so one other thing that happens is that during your schooling, you will go out early in the morning with one of their runners and you guys will see what it's like to work on running together. And they have a specialized harness that's different from the thicker leather harness. It's a little more lightweight, allows there to be a little more nimbleness as you run with your dog. And it's an amazing program. It's an amazing feeling to be able to actually run with you and your dog in this kind of symbiotic way where it's just you and man's best friend out there feeling the wind, you know, going through your hair. So that's something that Guiding Eyes offers. With that said, just two little informative pieces, because I see this question pop up now and then, and people turn to the center a lot of times to ask questions. I had a woman call here this week specifically to ask if her pup could be trained, her house pet right now could be trained to become a guide dog. And I just want to touch on that a little bit. These guide dog schools have been breeding these dogs to really maximize the things with them, their alertness, their health, the genetic quality. And so it's not just taking your pet, which could be great and could have amazing abilities, but these pups are raised from the cradle. It's a cradle to the grave type of thing. And not only that, the amount of training that goes into them, time, energy, and dollar amount, when they are done and they're delivered to us, it's about $75,000. And that is sweat, blood, donations, and tears that are poured into these dogs when we get them. So it's the equivalent of saying, you know, your family might have a nice Griswold sedan vehicle, but you can't soup it up enough to run in a NASCAR race. And so that's what it's going to be kind of with your house pet. They may be wonderful and great, but they're probably not going to get the time and the attention to become a guide dog, a service animal that you can really trust your life with. That's one thing. And the other part of it is you often, probably the majority of the time, need to have some what we call orientation and mobility training. It means you have to have worked with somebody who has showed you, trained with you to show you how to be able to travel independently. Because these guide dogs, they're not robots. You don't say go to 3520 Market Lane and they take you there. When you are at a street, you need to know when you're lined up at a corner to cross a street. Because if you're not lined up, guess what? They're going to take you diagonally across that intersection, all six lanes. So you still have to be able to orient yourself. You have to be able to listen to the traffic flow. When you're in a building, you can't say go to room 13 So you have to know how to orient yourself. So that O&M training is important. We do provide that at the center. And there's also a school called Leader Dogs. They're a guide dog school. They have a free O&M boot camp for people as well. So those are some big informational pieces. Is that, you know, Pet Fido is probably not going to be a guide dog. And you do need to commit to some training beforehand to be accepted as a guide at a guide dog school.
Katie.
Go ahead, Katie.
There is a video that Guiding Eyes has done. Great points, Nate. That pick of the litter will help give you some information on how they choose and pick. And these guide dogs are raised and trained to be someone that you can trust with your life to guide you across a safely across the street. Having a street name is something that I've brought up. A lot of people want to ask what your puppy's name is, and some people will tell you, and some will not, or they'll make something up. I mean, I've told my nieces, it's like if someone asks you what his name is, pick a name. And choose it, because if someone gets them distracted and they run us across unsafely, it can harm not only the dog but ourselves and cause even more problems. So safety for the dog and the human and the handler are one of the top priorities in the training.
Thank you, Katie. Yeah, definitely. One thing that I would like to emphasize is definitely the cost of these dogs. I like to joke and say that my dog is my Ferrari. And it was often the inside joke along my class of guide dog handlers that we are graduating with the keys to our Ferrari. So
or Lamborghini.
Or Lamborghini. That's a great one, too. yeah. And also just the research. If you are ready for a guide dog, please research all the schools. They're all great. Every single one does different things. There are a lot of Guiding Eyes handlers in Alaska, but definitely, and I mean, it was a long ways to go all the way to New York, and it was kind of scary, but there are closer schools. There's schools in California and Oregon, and so when you're ready, do the research, ask other guide dog handlers the questions, and that's all I have for the guide dog panel. Thank you so much, Nate and Katie, for the impromptu questions, and I'm handing it back to Kevin.
This is Bonnie. Can I add one thing? So in my chapter here in Syracuse, New York, there are five dogs who generally come to our meeting. We meet in a restaurant. All five of them are under the table, and one table. It's a long one, but they're all from Seeing Eye. So that seems to be very popular here in the Northeast. I have a client who went to Seeing Eye and just got back. So, you know, everybody each to his own. I think different people like different schools, and that's why the research is really important.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Bonnie. And one thing I will add to that is that if you're going to get a guide dog, make sure you have good cane skills. It is a must. I know some of the guide dog schools are providing you a week of orientation and mobility prior to getting your dog, but if you've got sufficient cane skills, they applaud that. They want you to have good cane skills. Before I could go down and get a dog, I had to get signed off by an orientation and mobility instructor that I had adequate cane skills and that I could protect the dog and keep myself safe as well. One thing is, I'm responsible for my safety as well as my dog's safety. Thank you, guys.
You and Raja. Raja's 12 and he's slowing down. Huh? And you're going to get another guide dog. So what's going to happen to Raja? Will he get adopted out to another family, or do you get to keep him, or what?
I'm going to have him stuffed. This year's sheddings, I'm saving it, going to make a headband out of it, so he'll always be with me. No, I'm joking there, too. No, I have a friend that he absolutely loves. She had an Australian Shepherd that lived to be over 16 years old, and she would take this dog to water aerobics. She would go have blood work done on it, and I thought to myself, Raja, when you retire, that's where you need to go. And she absolutely loves him, so he's going to go live up on the hillside with the...
Oh, good ending.
He's the luckiest dog in the world. Just waiting to hear from the guide dog school. I'm thinking probably around March or April. I'm hoping more latter in April or May in the springtime to get them, because I'll be in Norway in March. So
where the retired guide dog ends up is dependent on the handler. Some people keep them and are able to do that. Some of them give them to family and friends. And if that doesn't work, the puppy raisers get first choice if you have to return them to the school. So there's a few options for the guide dog.
And one thing, you know, that really sold me on the Guide Dog Foundation was that as I graduated from the school, I signed adoption papers for Raja. So when he left with me, I've been responsible for his health, his food. They gave me a $200 stipend to go towards heartworm pills, Doxycycline, or whatever. Since I've left, he's been my responsibility. So, and that has its benefits, and it also has its drawbacks too. So, again, getting a guide dog is a big responsibility. They have to go out every morning. They have to get active and walk on a regular basis. You are responsible to clean up after them, feed them, take care of them. They're just another member of the family. And if you're not ready for it, then that's okay too. But they are a great addition. I love my guide dog and couldn't imagine not having one.
There's a question, Kevin. Charlie here.
Yes.
With your frequent trips to Norway, were you able to take the dog with you, or how, or what are their rules and regs for somebody from U.S. taking a dog?
Well, he could have gone with me, but in order for him to travel, he has to have an international chip, and I have to pay $350 for a federal vet to inspect him. So that was too much money for me to take the dog overseas, but there is an opportunity to have that happen.
Is there an accommodation for like epilepsy or allergies?
Yes, you can get hypoallergenic dogs to if you have seizures. There's different types of service dogs for that. I know for the blind service dogs, I didn't pay a thing for Raja. They flew me down. They provided me with the dog.
If you check with the guide dog school, they will work with you if you have a specialty need. So I would reach out to the guide dog schools.
Chris Danielson, a representative from the national office, is going to speak to us on the Braille Monitor, our flagship presentation. Thank you, Chris.
I am Chris Danielson. I am the associate editor of the Braille Monitor. And the Braille Monitor is the flagship publication of the National Federation of the Blind. Basically, it is the best source of in-depth information about what is happening in the National Federation of the Blind. And we also try to publish relevant articles that will be of interest to the blind community, as well as articles that address the issues in our community that maybe we haven't reached consensus on. So we're also a publication that is interested in an exchange of views about the various issues that we face. That is the Braille Monitor. It is available online, but it is also available to you in Braille or large print. And it is sent to you by mail. So you have that option, and you can also have an audio version of it sent to you on a flash drive, and you can actually put that flash drive into the side port on the NLS Talking Book Player if you have one. And as long as you don't have a cartridge in the front of that player, it will treat that flash drive like a cartridge, and you will be able to navigate the Braille Monitor just like you would any Bard book. So it's available in all those formats. It's also available on NFB Newsline, in large print in Braille. And it's also available as a podcast. You can search your podcast client of choice for Braille Monitor. And you should find it and be able to download it each month. It's published 11 times per year. The reason for the 11 times instead of 12 is that we usually publish a double issue for August and September, because that's the issue that comes out after our national convention. So that's the Braille Monitor. And the thing is, we really like to have content from Federation members and people who support our cause. So you can definitely send content for the Braille Monitor, and there's information on the Braille Monitor webpage about how to do that or in the front of the Braille monitor when you receive it. And if you're not receiving it yet, you can call our national office at 410-659-9314. And there's an option on the main menu for monitor subscriptions and matters like that. And so you can get your subscription to the monitor, or you can change your address or do all those various things so that you can make sure that you are receiving our magazine. It's sort of the official record of what's happening in the National Federation of the Blind. It has been published since 1957. And so we're very proud of it. And it has a tremendous record of supporting our organization and advancing our cause. And in addition to Federation members, it is received by members of Congress, by teachers of blind students, by others in the blindness field. It has a circulation of approximately 30,000 people. So that's our Braille monitor.
Chris, thank you so very much. I know I receive a flash drive every month. I return my flash drives. And again, I have an NLS talking player.
The ways in how we can access the Braille monitor, whether it's calling the main line and choosing that option or connecting it through the Alexa app or other ways?
You can access it with NFB Newsline. You can call our main number, which is 410-659-9314. And when you call that main number, there will be an option on the main menu for monitor subscriptions. When you respond to that prompt, it will connect you with a voicemail box, and you can leave your information to make sure that you subscribe to the Braille monitor, and make sure that you specify whether you want it in large print or Braille or audio. And if you do that, you will either get a hard copy in large print, a hard copy in Braille, or you will get the flash drive. Now, if you don't want to do that, you can use your podcast client to subscribe to Braille Monitor. You can also go to our website at nfb.org. You can click on Publications and Media, and then there is another link on that page for the Braille monitor. You can open that page, and it will list all the subscription options. You can subscribe to the Braille monitor as an email, essentially an email with the text of the magazine. Those are the ways that you can get the Braille monitor.
Thank you so very much. Jack Menendez, Newsline.
So I'm going to talk briefly about what Newsline is, make a couple corrections from earlier, and then also talk about next steps here. A brief overview about what NFB Newsline is. It is a service of the National Federation of the Blind, accessible news and access to publications, magazines, newspapers, and other types of publications for subscribers in many different formats that make it usable and accessible to everybody. We have publications across a number of categories, over 590 publications, over 80 magazines, 14 what we consider to be national newspapers, and those are things like USA Today, Wall Street Journal, 23 international publications, quite a number of breaking news publications, or what we call breaking news online publications, candidate search. And what we do is we provide a search for the presidential and vice presidential candidate accessible via the various methods I've talked about. And we feel that it is important to give people the information they need to make the decision that they feel is best for them. Really, that is now accessible, and that spans across any number of publications while that candidate search remains active. Okay, so we really do our best to make sure that we give people as much information as we can. Want to try NFB Newsline? I know that Freya spoke yesterday from the Talking Book Center,
One way that you can get qualified is through the talking book libraries or talking book center in your case. And because we need to validate that you do have a print disability or blind. And that's one way. If you've qualified for that service, then you're qualified to be a subscriber for Newsline. NFP Newsline is available in 47 states. Unfortunately, Alaska is one of the states where it's not available. Wyoming and North Dakota are the others. But we would love to get Newsline in your state. It is super, super vital to my day, not only because I use it to keep myself informed. We are here to help your state get access. That's what I have. Anybody have any questions?
You left everybody speechless, Jack. Thank you so very much.
You're very welcome.
Unfortunately, Newsline is kind of a hot topic. You know, we talk about it every year. We've done our best to try and get it here with Alaska and our legislators. Lifeline phone and that stuff came out with X amount of data that came with the phone. Our legislators thought it's not necessary for us. And, you know, and it's up to us as the blind to let them know that we need it. And with the broadband in Alaska, there's no reason why we shouldn't have it available for us. So I look forward to talking with you and Scott and seeing what we can do about making Newsline accessible to us here in Alaska. And some of us that have been to some of the training centers have been down to the lower 48, have the app on our phone and still are able to use it. You know, it's wonderful. It's truly great. You know, I use it from time to time. Any state I'm at, I can look up any newspaper, any magazine or anything that's going on. I get updates from the NFB through it. So it is a valuable asset and I do want to promote it and get it up here in Alaska. So thank you very much. Legislation. We have a couple of recordings from our senators, and we have a message from our House representative. And along with that, is William Craig online with us? Okay. I thought I'd give him an opportunity to give us an update on what he's been doing. I know he's been working on getting something passed through a resolution for Braille accessibility in the schools and Braille teachers. So he has a resolution going through with the Human Rights Commission, the Blind Commit Coalition that he's on. So that's very interesting. He's doing a lot of hard work. And as we've heard throughout the convention, he's very passionate about what he does. And, you know, we are grateful to have him on our legislative team.
We got the statement from our U.S. representative, as people are fond of saying, Alaska has only one congressman. Okay, and that's U.S. Representative. That's Mary Peltola. And so she has sent us a written statement. She says, to NFB Alaska State Convention attendees, thank you for the many decades you've dedicated to helping blind and low vision Alaskans get the resources, programs, and services they deserve. I commend you for the strides you've taken since 1977 to make Alaska a more inclusive and considerate state, ensuring that our way of life is accessible to all. The resources and network you have created allow people who are blind to accomplish these goals and dreams because blindness shouldn't stand in the way of a successful livelihood and fulfilling career. That is why I am a co-sponsor of the Access Technology Affordability Act.
Yes, yes.
Money should not prevent the adoption of this life-changing technology for your communities. This act will amend the Internal Revenue Code of 1986 to allow a refunding tax credit against income tax for purchasing qualified access technology for individuals who are blind. The technology covered includes screen reader like JAWS or VoiceOver, which can translate on-screen text to speech, and Braille keyboards. You shouldn't have to pay extra for these essential life-altering technologies. I continue looking for ways to support all Alaskans, especially those facing blindness and low vision. Let my team in Alaska and D.C. know how they can better help and assist you. Thank you again for the opportunity to provide remarks today, And please keep in touch. You will always have my support. Sincerely, Mary Peltola, that's Mary Sadler Peltola, member of Congress. Okay.
All right. Yes, here.
It's Linda. I kind of just wanted to share a little bit of what it's like when we go down and go to Washington, meet with our representatives and our senators. It's really touching because they take the time for us. And I had a funny story that I've shared with a few of you. Mary Peltola is working very hard, trying to hit every community in Alaska. And this time of the year, you know, the weather is not always the easiest to get from place to place. And on Thursday for Halloween, she was going to land in Juneau and be at a Halloween parade with the kids and then have a costume party contest and meet with folks at Bullwinkle's. And so many of you know that when I put on my native earrings or if I wear a cusbuck, I've been mistaken for Mary Peltola. And so I decided for Halloween I would be Mary Peltola. And I went to Bullwinkle's Pizza Place to meet with her and take my picture with her. And it turned out her flight had gotten fogged out. But several people came to talk to me thinking I was Mary Peltola. So it was very fun. And I took a picture with her staffers and another anonymous person. And they sent it to her and she got a kick out of that. So it was really sweet. And she herself has a family member who is blind. So she's really listens and takes the time for us. I find it just very moving that she does truly care.
Thank you.
So guys, I got to go to Washington seminar for the first time this year. Oh my gosh. Let me tell you, pack the right shoes because I walked the bottoms of my shoes off. There is so much walking in Washington, D.C. We were there for a total of 4 days and I had the pleasure of staying with Linda and we, man, I wish I could remember in which order we met with who, because even though it was only 4 days, it is kind of similar to National Convention in the fact that you just kind of go, 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 and you're doing the things and seeing the people. One comment Senator Sullivan said to us was, wow, there sure is a lot of you blind people here. What's this, your National Convention? So that was pretty fun to explain to him why we were there and what we were doing. The meeting with Mary Peltola was very fast. So that's something also very interesting about these trips is we take a lot of time and energy to go down there. And I'm sure it takes a lot of time out of their schedule to try and squeeze us in. But I was so anxious and nervous. We were originally supposed to have a coffee and kind of a lunch meeting with Mary Peltola. But because of how crazy things are in Washington, D.C., her schedule got shifted and she had to go vote. But she still made 5 minutes to sit down with us, hear what we had to say, give us a big hug and give us that loving support she just did in that statement. That was really great. And so what I was where I was going with that is I had so much anxiety and so excited about these meetings and it was just 5 minutes. But they're so impactful. And it was sort of a similar situation with Dan Sullivan. We got a little bit more of his time and he was also very supportive. And it's an amazing journey. I have so many stories to tell from Washington Seminar, and I really cannot wait to go next year and represent Alaska again. I really hope in the future we can get more individuals to join us. And that's some of my story. I can tell you more later. I've done so much more with the student division since. And yeah, I'm excited for our future, y'all.
To the Washington Seminar, you don't just go there unprepared. The NFB, the national reps, will send a advocate with you. If you're not familiar with what the policies are, they hold seminars, they hold mock interviews, they prepare you for what's going on so that you don't go in there unequipped and unprepared. And it truly is a lot of fun and it's an experience you'll never forget. So again, it's encouraging to have others come and experience our nation's capital and what takes place there. Let's listen to what our other senators have to say about the National Federation of the Blind.
Hello, Alaska, and thank you for the opportunity to say a few words at the convention that you're having for the National Federation of the Blind in Alaska's chapter. By the way, I really, really admire and respect so many of you for addressing these big, challenging issues. You know, we have a lot of challenges in our state, and people with disabilities have specific challenges that I think sometimes we have a great state, but it makes living with some of those disabilities even tougher. And I know for our blind community and visually impaired, there are things that make Alaska uniquely challenging. So I always look forward to a meeting with all of you. And I want to thank particularly those who are volunteering at the convention today. Thank you all for your great work. So what are we doing? Well, I think one of the things that we try to focus on is making sure that the federal government is aware that one size does not fit all on issues that relate to our state. One size does not fit all, certainly as it relates to Alaskans with disabilities. So one of the things that we worked hard on that I think helps everybody, but I think will have a particularly positive impact for the visually impaired and blind and others with disabilities is some of the infrastructure build-out that we are doing in our state. I like to say we are a resource-rich but infrastructure-poor state. We have less road miles than Connecticut, and we are 120 times bigger than Connecticut. One of the real critical areas that I've been focused on in terms of infrastructure is with regard to broadband connectivity. Think about it. If we can bring broadband and internet connectivity at high speeds to every Alaska community, and that's what we're trying to do, in urban areas, in rural areas, this will have a positive impact on every citizen of our state. But I think it will have a really positive impact on those with disabilities and the visually impaired and the blind. So we are doing that. In the infrastructure bill, the bipartisan infrastructure bill, we are able to get a formula in there that dramatically increases and, to be honest, favors the great state of Alaska when it comes to infrastructure build-out, particularly broadband and internet connectivity. Another thing that I think is going to be helpful is my Link Act that was passed last December. This creates a network of care between physical and social health services to make it easier for patients to understand what resources are available to them. And again, I think this is in particularly helpful for Alaskans with disabilities. So we are going to continue to work on these issues. Again, I want to thank you. The visit I get from your team in my offices here in Anchorage or back in D.C. are very impactful. Thank you for all you do. Know that my door is always open, and we look forward to hearing about some of the really big ideas that come from your conference. Have a great conference.
Great to know that our representatives support us in our movement and what we're doing. Now we're ready for Senator Murkowski.
Well, hello, and thank you for the opportunity to welcome you to your annual state convention, where you gather to address issues that are important to Alaska's visually impaired community. As we reflect on how to address significant workforce shortages across our nation, we know that a job is a sense of purpose and opportunities to build essential lives. And that's why it's been a goal of mine to remove barriers to job opportunities. I'm co-sponsoring one initiative that's critical to this mission, and that's the Access Technology Affordability Act of 2020. This legislation provides a $2,000 refundable tax credit for individuals to purchase essential accessibility devices, like screen readers, that often aren't covered. By expanding access to these tools is vital. And this tax credit enables. I want to thank all of you for your efforts, your continued efforts in education and advocacy in Alaska as you work to improve the lives of visually impaired. I'm committed to being your partner at the federal level as we work towards creating personal growth for Alaska's visually impaired community. So enjoy your convention. Thank you so much and take care.
All right.
Linda, again, this last trip to Washington seminar, Senator Murkowski was not available, but her staffers were wonderful. They sat with us, took lots of notes, lots of questions, and gave Kelsey and I a private tour all over
the Capitol. Wow. And we got to see the Helen Keller Monument, and they have a tactile map of Washington, D.C. Yeah. that we got to feel. So they gave us the Alaskan touch. It was very nice.
Right on. And it's also nice to see that our hard work is paying off. We have two representatives that are sponsoring the ATA Act, and that's what we go there for, to get them to sponsor these resolutions to get passed. So congratulations for Kelsey and Linda for doing that hard work and making it happen for us. So,
This is Candy. I got a dumb question. I didn't quite catch the name of the person that was talking before, Senator Murkowski.
That was Dan Sullivan.
Kelsey, I just wanted to say real quickly, since I didn't get a chance this morning, that the student division has been so supportive of me, and they gave me a scholarship as well as our state division to get to Washington Seminar. After I got to Washington Seminar, they invited me onto the membership committee, and I was able to participate in that and learn so many new things from that and attend so many more student seminars. I attended the Rocky Mountain Seminar in Colorado. I attended the Leadership Seminar and Maryland, and I was able to go to National Convention. After National Convention, they asked me out to be on the Advocacy Committee, so I get to help them plan part of Washington Seminar this year, and I'm just really excited, and I'm so grateful for the opportunity, and I cannot wait to get more of us there.
You're going to need to get a new pair of retreaded shoes.